I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat & Three, it's our season 4 finale, and we're sharing some of our greatest kitchen joys.
Maybe most people consider making it too much work or too messy, but this is the food that's worth the work and worth the wait.
You always know where the thing is because you put it away the right way the first time.
You just sort of stand there in front, you know, with your hand on your hip and one leg outstretched, glass of wine in your hand, staring into the refrigerator going, okay, speak to me.
Oh yeah, what are you doing with the celery tonight?
I'm making a simple syrup for a gin cocktail with the celery. And I also found a recipe for a celery soup that's going to use up the celery and the potatoes and some of that dill that we still have hanging out in there.
Tune in and be inspired to find the joy in your kitchen. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat & Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. Today we're going to talk about meat, which is pretty much my favorite subject. Over the past 10 years, I've covered a lot of meat stories. I even wrote a book about meat. And today we are going to be speaking with one of my favorite guests, Leah Douglas. Leah is a staff writer and associate editor at the Food and Environment Reporting Network, also known as FERN, which is an independent nonprofit newsroom that publishes investigative and explanatory reporting on food, agriculture, and environmental health. Her reporting on corporate power and big business in the food and agricultural sectors has been published in The Guardian, The Nation, The Washington Post, Mother Jones, Time, Fortune, NPR, and other outlets. Welcome to the show, Leah. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So what made me want to contact you was that you and Chris Leonard, who is another person whose work I admire enormously and who has been hugely informationally useful to me, it went through his book, The Meat Racket, which I interviewed him about a few times back in the day. You guys co-wrote a recent article, which was published in The Guardian as well as at The Fern, on price fixing in the poultry industry. So can you give us a little background on the issue and why you guys wrote the article?
Sure. So our story discussed allegations of price fixing of farmers' wages in the poultry sector. So there's been a lot of lawsuits brought in the past few years in the poultry sector, mostly alleging fixing of prices of chicken for consumers. And it's been a major issue in the sector. And so our story, our contribution to that landscape was also allegations that have been brought about the fixing of farmers' wages, and that some of the same tactics that that distributors and customers and wholesalers have alleged are being used to hike prices up on the consumer end for chicken can also be used to suppress wages for farmers. And so the main tool at play there is a data sharing service called AgriStats, and farmers are concerned about the use of that data sharing, not only for the wages in and of themselves, but also just for the amount of power that this type of alleged collusion gives the chicken companies when they're in negotiations with farmers. So that was the scope of this story.
So, right. So when I first started hearing about these price fixing suits, they were originally, the first class action suit was brought in January of 2016 by Maplevale Farms, which is a New York-based distributor. And they filed a lawsuit in Chicago alleging price fixing. And that was the price fixing that you're referring to that has to do with what they were charging distributors and grocery store chains and presumably other institutional buyers. And then after that, there were further filings in October of 2016, which caught my eye as well. I did a show on those suits. And then in January of 2018, U.S. Foods and Sysco also brought a class action suit alleging price fixing. And, you know, as you just mentioned, in every case, Agristats was the tool with which these companies were able to collude. So what exactly is the information that Agristats provides that allows companies to use it in this way to fix prices?
Sure. So Agristats provides extremely granular data about many, many corners of the chicken production sector. And the data that is goes into Agristats reports is aggregated from about 95% of all poultry companies in the country. And reports are produced every day. So they really give an up-to-the-minute a survey of all this different data about what's going on in the poultry sector. So, for instance, relevant to the Maplevale case and other cases that have been brought by wholesalers and distributors and consumers, Agristats reports can include data about how much poultry companies are charging at the wholesale level for chicken. And those suits allege that that information can be used to set prices artificially high. And our reporting, we were able to consult a leaked Agristats report and confirm that the reports also include data about how much farmers are paid. So that had not previously been reported, that Agristats reports include information like how much farmers are paid per pound in different right. plants all over the country, how that pay is different regionally versus nationally, and so on. So there's all different nuances of how those wages are set included in the Agristats report.
That is absolutely breathtaking, isn't it? I mean, really incredible. So earlier this summer, you reported that the Justice Department appeared poised to launch a grand jury investigation into these allegations of price fixing. What impact does that have on those class action suits, if any? I mean, does this mean that they're actually going to bring criminal charges, for instance, or, bust Agristats, or I don't know what can be done? You know, let's start with that. What does the DOJ investigation suggest?
Sure. So this is a pretty surprising update in the sort of landscape of these lawsuits. And antitrust experts have told me that the DOJ's intervention in the Maplevale case, which is sort of the cornerstone case alleging this price fixing, was pretty unusual and should be taken fairly seriously. Essentially, what the Department of Justice did was they motioned to stop discovery, so the sort of internal investigation happening in the Maplevale case, for several months so that they could, so that it wouldn't interfere with their own grand jury investigation. And we don't know much about the content of that grand jury investigation. We know about the investigation itself because the filings from the poultry companies revealing that they were subpoenaed in the course of the suit and because of this motion to stay in Maplevale. So the Department of Justice did get 3 months of stayed discovery in the Maplevale case, which basically means they have 3 months of just their own investigation. At the end of September, that clock will run up, and I'm sure there'll be more discussion about next steps. And antitrust experts say it could signal criminal charges, and it's of course, impossible to know until those charges are brought. We don't really have a lens into what's happening at the DOJ, but it is pretty unusual.
It is unusual. And also, like, I'm curious, like, how, even though there's price fixing, each one of these entities that are being charged, presumably, and altogether there were 18 plaintiffs, weren't there, in the price fixing? Is that
yes.
How many, or was it just the big, you know, Tyson, Coke Foods, Purdue, Sanderson, I guess Pilgrim's Pride would probably come in under that rubric as well. Who exactly is being charged? Is it more than those guys, or is it just those entities?
It really depends lawsuit to lawsuit. For the most part, there are a couple lawsuits that are essentially bringing charges against every major poultry producer that has any type of national scale. Of course, the biggest of those are the ones you just named, Tyson Food, Pilgrim's Pride, Coke Foods, and so on. But there are several others that are included in that list. As insofar as the Department of Justice investigation, we know about a couple of the companies' subpoenas through their own filings or through confirmation to other reporting outlets, and we don't know necessarily every single one yet.
Right. And when we talk about that potentially leading to some sort of antitrust activity, help me connect those dots. Like, how would price fixing amongst those companies, they're all separate companies. So where does the antitrust aspect of this come in? How would they leverage that?
Sure. So again, it sort of depends on what the DOJ, what sort of lens they use to approach it. I did have one antitrust expert tell me that if criminal charges were brought, then the named entity could be the CEO of those companies. It would have to be some person. So maybe a single or a group of executives. And so it sort of depends on what their approach is.
Right. And is Agristats named in any of these suits or investigations? Their job is to provide this information. They're paid for doing this information. Are they criminally liable for providing it, or are they somehow, just kind of an innocent bystander in this? How do they stand in this?
Sure. So Agristats is named in all of the lawsuits that have been brought from the consumer and wholesaler side and from the farmer side. And Agristats essentially has been investigated in the past at one point by the Department of Justice, and that investigation found no wrongdoing on the part of Agristats, which is another reason why the current investigation is so interesting, because it appears, and again, we can't confirm at this moment, but it appears that this question is being reopened at the Department of Justice, where previously it was investigated and sort of found to be innocuous in the eyes of the Department of Justice. So, of course, Agristats and the poultry companies would say that this is merely a way to share information with one another and not being used as a tool for collusion, which is what's alleged in the suit. But of course, many antitrust experts and all the plaintiffs involved in the lawsuits have said that the act of data sharing in and of itself has been the tool that has allowed the artificial hiking up of consumer prices and the suppression of farmer wages.
Yeah, right. But they also claim that the reason that they need this data is presumably to control supply and demand as well. Not that I'm trying to defend Agristats, but I'm just trying to understand how an agency or a company like Agristats would be considered criminally liable for simply providing data about an industry. And corollary to that, aren't there other similar organizations that provide that same type of granular information to other industries? And in that case, wouldn't this have sort of a chilling effect on that sort of data dissemination?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's really at the crux of a lot of these lawsuits. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of a sort of a comparable service in other sectors. I have asked numerous experts about that because, of course, it would be helpful to know how other industries were sort of interrogating this question. And there could be. I'm just not aware of any. Sort of the hinge that's been used in the past is, can this information, the defense that Agristats has used, let's say, is that the information they're providing is up to the minute, but not predictive. So they would say the test for collusion is, are we together saying this is the future price of chicken and this is what the price that everyone will meet in the future? And their argument would be that their data is not sharing that. It's just sharing everything that's happened in the past up to 30 seconds ago, say. That's the nuance that's being interrogated by these lawsuits.
Right. And I also read that they don't actually name each company. They use a number. But as somebody was quoted in one of the articles I read to prepare for this, it was like, if you read these pages or, get this information for long enough, you start figuring out that company number one is Tyson, company number two is Sanderson. It doesn't take, a PhD to figure out who they're referring to when they produce these results, which is what everybody is looking at to see what, X, Y, and Z are using for their price points. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to puzzle this out. I think that's a very interesting part of it, because I like you, I don't know for sure that this type of business exists in other industries or even in other sectors of the agricultural industry, but I feel pretty sure that they must. Because, like, this can't be a one-off, you know what I mean? But anyway, let's just give a little background here, just so people, I wanted to talk, actually, I completely, you know, botched this outline because I'm all like excited because it's my first show back. But anyway, let's just give people a little background on the poultry industry, because they are making record-breaking profits right now. And part of that, I think, is one of the reasons that people are beginning to examine these, or bringing these class action suits. So to start with, what is the average per pound that a poultry grower, a farmer who has, you know, a large chicken house, say 10 or 20,000 birds, what is his average per pound?
Sure. So according to the National Chicken Council, which is sort of the biggest industry trade group, as of 2015, the average price per pound was about 6 cents for growers. And actually, that is, when adjusted for inflation, lower than what farmers were making in the 1980s on a cents per pound basis. So one of the main reasons that farmers have been really agitated around the poultry companies and the record-breaking profits is that farmers have actually seen wages steadily decreasing in the past 30 years, despite, of course, inflation adjusting their wages in the market.
Right. And in the meantime, let's remind people that, you know, let's go through these stats, and then I'm gonna ask you to give a quick thumbnail of just exactly how these contracts work, because it's a very specific and ever-growing business model for animal agriculture. I mean, the hog industry has followed suit, and they're trying to figure out how to make cattle work the same way. So now, how much are grocery stores or institutional buyers paying per pound wholesale?
So right now in 2019, it's about 80 cents a pound for grocery wholesale broilers, which is essentially the chicken that you buy at the grocery store. And that's also according to the National Chicken Council. And for customers are paying about $1.90 a pound.
And so how much have we seen prices rise as a result of this, what we would allege to be price fixing? Let's put it this way. How much have prices risen over the last, say, 10 years?
Sure. So the lawsuits that are alleging that prices have been kept artificially high for customers all sort of focus on this 10-year range between 2008 and 2016, or I guess that's more like 8 or 9 years. And according to the lawsuits, during that period, there was about a 50% rise in prices, which the suits would point to this allegation of coordination on pricing to be the cause for that rise.
Right. And so what kind of profits are these large companies taking home in that case, given that we're seeing this, you know, significant rise in prices? Meanwhile, let's point out that the cost of the commodities involved, like the feed, have actually fallen because soybean and corn prices have gone much lower since 2010.
Sure. So during that same time period that's focused on in the lawsuits, profits have really spiked at these the biggest poultry companies. And my colleague Chris Leonard, who wrote the Guardian story with me, did a big piece for Bloomberg in 2017 that looked at this. And it looked at AgriStats broadly and noted that for Tyson Foods in that time period, profits rose from 1.6% to nearly 12%. And that at Pilgrim's Pride, they rose from about under 4% to 12.7%. So those are huge
Holy
spikes in just 8 or 9 years.
That is breathtaking. Boy, too bad we didn't buy stock in those companies, huh? I could retire on a 12% increase. Jesus. So in the meantime, the average farmers, contract growers' income is less, in fact, as you said earlier, you said it was less than it was in the 80s. What is the average income for a contract grower?
I mean, it really depends on the size of the operation. I mean, these farms can have anywhere from a few thousand to several million chickens a year. So it really depends on the size. But many growers will report that they are living in poverty conditions or near poverty conditions. So we're really not looking at people who are even really able to obtain a middle-class lifestyle on the income that they're making.
That's right. And, you know, let's remind people that just as an aside, because I really should have asked you to delineate this or in the beginning of the program, but the way it works with contract growers, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they contract with a big integrator like Tyson or Purdue. And they say, Purdue will say, I'm going to send you, 10,000 chickens a year and this or a season. You're going to grow out that flock. And then you'll, make whatever it is we decide to pay you per pound. Now, isn't it also true, and I learned this from Chris Leonard's Meat Racket, isn't it also true that they can vary the price that they pay the farmers, and they do vary the price that they can pay the farmers depending on how that farmer does in terms of what is called a tournament?
Yes, exactly. So farmer pay varies enormously from flock to flock, and how and why it varies is pretty opaque to the farmer. Farmers are paid in sort of a zero-sum system where any rise in wages that a farmer sees is taken out of a neighboring farmer's pocket. So there's sort of a certain amount of money being distributed to a certain set of farmers, and everyone's competing for that without really knowing why and how their wages are being docked when they are.
Right. Right. And also, there's also the fact that the integrator, the big company, Tyson, Purdue et al., that they also have the right to demand that a farmer upgrade their facilities, again, with a very opaque rationale behind that. They may decide that their flock requires a certain type of ventilation system or a certain type of roosting system or something like that. And farmers are on the hook for providing that, or they do not get another flock. Isn't that correct?
Yes, exactly. So a cornerstone of the contract model is that farmers own only their farm and the structures and equipment on their farm. They don't own the chickens, the feed. All of that is controlled by the companies, but they're responsible for by far the riskiest and most expensive part of a farming operation, which is the equipment and the land itself, which, generally speaking, a farmer will need several million dollars in investment to even open their doors to start growing chickens and let alone down the line trying to pay that off.
Now, when you look at like a Tyson or a Purdue website, and I'm going way off topic here, as I always do, this is why I have to write an outline or I'm just all over the map. But it occurs to me right now as we're talking, like they say that, typically their contracts run for 10 to 15 years and that their growers are, making a great wage and that everything is hunky-dory. I just wonder how they are able to continue that fiction when more and more information has emerged saying absolutely to the contrary, that is not what's going on. So I mean, that is just an aside. I don't think I require any sort of response unless you have one. But I mean, isn't that sort of the party line is that, yes, they have to take out loans. Yes, they have to upgrade, but it's only so they can make more money. Isn't that pretty much what they're telling farmers?
Sure. I mean, the companies have absolutely maintained that they have fair and competitive wages for farmers, that their contracts are long enough to provide farmers security, and that they're always working to improve the conditions of those contracts. That does contradict with what I and many other reporters hear from farmers themselves, which is they essentially live in a constant state of precarity, not knowing often when their next flock will arrive, and having contracts that only last the length of maybe one flock or perhaps 6 months, perhaps a year at the sort of outside. So certainly there are cases that vary from that norm, but I'm still hearing that the norm tends towards those short-term contracts and that level of instability with low wages.
And then one final point I want to make, and then we'll take a break and move on to something else. But one final point I wanted to make about this was that that farmers because they have to take out these massive loans in order to service these birds. If they don't know that they're going to get another flock right away, that has tremendous financial implications for their future because there are no other integrators to go to. In other words, the consolidation of the industry has contracted to the point where you might say, oh, well, I'm not going to work for Tyson anymore because they just screwed me. I'm going to go work for Purdue. But that doesn't happen because Purdue will not take that farmer on, possibly, or they don't exist in that particular part of the country. Isn't that another, a further issue for farmers who work in the contract system?
Yes, absolutely. So at a national scale, the consolidation that we've seen in the sector means that there's, you know, four, five, six companies that sort of float to the top and control the vast majority of the market nationally. But at a regional level and a local level, that consolidation is even more extreme. So there might be, you know, a grower in a certain area that only has one or two options of where they can sell to, and they can't simply move from one processor to another to ask for better working conditions or better wages or other types of improvements. So the consolidation nationally is even more exacerbated locally, which has a much more intense impact on the farmers themselves.
Right, absolutely. And that's why we call it consolidation and anti-competitive business practices. Okay, let's take a quick break. And we'll be right back with Leah Douglas from The Fern, the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. We're going to be talking more about collusion within the poultry industry. Stay tuned.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com. The questions that lead us on.
We are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, in case I didn't say that before. And we're talking with Leah Douglas. We are talking about the poultry industry because we are a nation of chicken eaters. I think the statistic that I read still seems to be about 9 billion chickens a year that we produce in this country. We don't consume all of them, but we do consume a lot of them. So Leah, another thing that caught my eye and came out just a few days ago, I think on the 4th of September, I saw an article saying that a new lawsuit has been launched pertaining to the wages of poultry workers. Now, you were implying that this was farmers, but I understood it to be the people who work in the processing facilities. Am I incorrect in that?
Yes. So this new reporting that came out just last week about the latest lawsuit against the poultry companies does pertain to the workers at the plants themselves. So our reporting, mine and Chris's reporting, has pertained to farmers' wages. And now this new lawsuit pertains to the workers who work in the processing plant.
Right. So it is alleged that 18 companies, including the same big companies we've been talking about this whole, half hour, have also been colluding on depressing wages and other compensations to hundreds of thousands of workers since 2009. And again, AgriStats is kind of the lead information behind this conspiracy. Maybe we should talk about the ICE raid on Koch Farms in Mississippi, because one of the ways in which all meat processing companies are able to keep wages low is by hiring undocumented workers. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Sure. So it's absolutely been the backbone of the poultry industry to rely heavily on immigrant labor and in many cases, undocumented immigrant labor across the country. And so this did reach a national profile several weeks ago when ICE raided the Koch Foods factory in Missouri and arrested hundreds of people who were working at the plant. And this is just one example of a very common industry trend. And so this new lawsuit alleges on behalf of those workers that the companies have been using AgriStats along with the allegations that they use AgriStats to artificially raise prices for consumers, and alongside the allegations that they use agrostats to suppress wages for farmers, that the companies are also using agrostats to suppress wages for factory workers.
Right. And that's how you get achieve a 12% growth over the course of 8 years. I mean, nice work if you can get it, right? I mean, unbelievable. So let's go back to the litigation. What do you think is going to be the end game here? Like, now that we know that agrostats is part and parcel of a, you know, basically industry-wide conspiracy, alleged conspiracy to rip off the farmers, suppress wages, and raise prices for consumers. What's going to be the end game of this? Do you think it will resolve in big antitrust suits? Will it resolve in favor of, will it just be that the companies just pay those class action fines, you know, they just brush those? Because, I mean, really, a class action suit doesn't really seem to end up changing much of anything in my observation. It's just kind of like, oh, they pay a big fine and then they just go back to business as usual. So what do you think will happen?
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see. I mean, agrostats is now fighting off just dozens of lawsuits. I think that the main place to watch will be this Department of Justice investigation. I think whatever happens there, if the Department of Justice does decide that there is anti-competitive conduct happening in this sector, that will be a major watershed moment for the sector. On the other hand, if the Department of Justice decides there is not any type of anti-competitive conduct, I'm sure there will be a ripple effect into this other ongoing litigation. So we'll really have to wait and see. And I think, you know, it's worth noting, again, that the poultry companies and agrostats deny all these allegations. So we're going to have to see how it plays out in court.
Absolutely. Well, under the Barr, William Barr, as our Attorney General of the United States, I think it's anybody's guess what's going to happen. I'm not especially optimistic that things will turn out as perhaps you and I might hope. But, you know, maybe the leopard will change his spots. It's just one doesn't know. But it is certainly interesting that they're even taking up this case, actually. I find that kind of encouraging. If nothing else. So I'm hoping for the best. But, you know, hopefully you and I will talk about this again as the whole process moves forward in the court system, because this really will have quite significant implications for other aspects of the agricultural portfolio, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I think it is fascinating, as you know, as we both noted, that this is happening at the scale that it is now. And I think it's being very closely watched, I'm sure, by many other agriculture industry watchers, and I'll certainly be following it. So I think it does have implications for the whole sector and for our whole conversation about the agriculture system and how it's structured, which I think is why it's receiving the attention that it is. I think it's a pretty important moment, and it's a pretty exciting time for the conversation.
Yeah, well, we'll hope it moves forward. So now you have an opportunity to promote yourself shamelessly, Leah Douglas. Go ahead and tell people all about where they can find you.
Well, thanks so much. You can follow my work at thefern.org. That's the Fern website. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leah J. Douglas. And I post all my work there. And I look forward to hearing from you. And thank you so much for having me, Katie.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. And we'll be in touch very soon. We'll set up another few things going, depending on what you're working on. I want to hear all about it. Thank you so much, Leah.
Sounds great.
And thanks to my sponsor.
You.
And thank you to my engineer, and we'll be back next week with another great show. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.